Well, I've never seen such a room full of friends in my life.
Thank you.
My name is Art. I'm an alcoholic. Because I am, and am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do have these friends. I look around the room here, and there's very few people I haven't sat in a meeting with. And that makes me feel really wonderful. You know, I got a whole list of stuff that I want to talk about. And if I get to three or four of them, I'll probably be lucky. But alcoholism is an illness, as we keep being told. A lot of us doubt that. We think it's all in our head. But there's something happens to us when we become alcoholic, and that we cannot drink without some real bad things happening to us. And it's a strange illness. You know, everybody's got a lot of reasons why we become alcoholic. How come I'm an alcoholic? You know, was it my mother or what have you? Lynn Carroll, the guy that ran the treatment center that I went to, in his talk, he says, I wasn't knocked in the head with a feather to become an alcoholic. I became alcoholic because I drank alcohol. And I know from observation and for think of my own life that anybody can become alcoholic. All they have to do is drink alcohol for a long enough period of time, and they will become alcoholic. But that's the way it happened to me anyway, because I didn't get to this program until I was 47 years old. Now, I was kind of stubborn, but I just didn't think that I had a problem with alcohol. Everything else was the way it was. I grew up in a good Irish Catholic family in Canada. My parents didn't drink when I was young, but they drank later on. And there was alcohol in our home. We had alcohol, beer or something, for parties and that sort of thing. But I try to think back. I'm sure I tasted alcohol when I was a kid, just sipping a drink here or there and that the other thing. But I was also told when I came around this program that, we need to remember the first drink and the last drink. And I can remember quite vividly my first drink. And I mean by the first drink, the one that gave me the buzz that made me want to continue drinking. I had been taking piano lessons at the insistence of my mother. And the piano teacher, a guy by the name of Eddie Vesna, and his brother had a camp that they were putting together for boys, and they needed some staff, so he put the arm on me to come and help him with it. He didn't promise to pay anything, but he said, well, I'll give you three meals a day and you'll spend spending money, And I was about 17, and maybe 18. Anyway, we get up there, we put up these tents for the kids, and there was one big tent with the dining area, and it was full of mattresses and things to put around, and we did a pretty heavy day. There must have been 15 or 20 of us there, Somebody brought out a bottle of booze and started passing around, and I'm thinking, they're not going to pass it to me, but they did. They passed one to me, and I took a swig of it and passed around until the bottle was gone, And it gave me a glow. I've never forgotten that glow. And I chased it so long, you know, I was about 17 or 18, you know, 47, I finally found out what it was killing me. But that's what I was chasing, that feeling. There was a young lady there that had, you know, she was well endowed, and I thought she was kind of cute, and I ended up chasing her around the room. They all thought that was funny to them. I never did chase her. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that got me started on this thing. And then they took me to a tavern while I was there, and I had a beer. And I can still remember the smell. Actually, it was ale, probably, but it was the smell of the beer or ale. And the atmosphere just made me happy. That was the way I wanted things. Well, a year or so later, I joined the Navy. It was wartime, and I was too young to get a tot of rum. The Canadian Navy used to give you a tot of rum at 11 o'clock. And I was too young for that. I had to wait until I was 19. And they gave me a choice then. I could have a tot of rum or 6 cents a day, but you know what I took. The first ship I was on was a Fairmat, which was a motor launch, did patrol duty in the Newfoundland area. And the regulations for the tot was you had to drink it in front of an officer. You know, you get up there and you drink it. But they let the regulations slip a little bit. We used to take it down the mess deck and fill up a fifth bottle with it, another guy and I. And when it got about three-quarter full, we sit down and have ourselves a little party. And that was the way things went with me as far as the Navy's concerned. I had my first blackout when I was in the Navy. And I remember waking up back on board ship. I hadn't got a clue how I got there. And I was covered with sickness. It was a mess. I had a lot of nights like that in the next couple of years while I was in the Navy. When I left the Navy, I went back to school, and my weekend soldiers at partying, I just didn't apply myself well enough. I didn't quite finish what they called a DVA. I think it was called it. It gave us education for a month of education for a month of service. And so I had enough to have 4 years of engineering education. And I flunked out of my second year and decided to go back the second and try it again and gave up. Yeah. And I went to work. I drank on weekends. And, when I was working on that job up in Northern Ontario, I drank every day. But, you know, my memory's kind of sloppy. Fast forward to getting married, moving to the United States. I got a job in Canada and got the opportunity to move to the United States. And I came down here, and my alcohol consumption was down to very rarely, you know. But as I became better at my job and had a more important, quotation marks, position, I had the opportunity to do some drinking, and I drank at every opportunity, actually. I rarely got drunk, but I drank a lot. And my children grew up. We moved to Gary when they were about 3 and 4, and we moved out of Gary when they were out of high school. And but during that period of time is when my alcoholism grew, because I got into some habits. The habit of having a lunchtime drink, the habit of having a cocktail before dinner, and the habit of having a party at every opportunity. You always have a case of beer around from the chores as you're working during the weekend, you know. And I just kept drinking and drinking and drinking. Now, I didn't get into any serious trouble ever. I didn't get picked up by the cops. I didn't get any DUIs. I just simply was lucky, I guess. And I was, until the latter part of my drinking, I was kind of one of those happy drunks. I could, you know, talk somebody into almost anything when I was drinking. I lost all my inhibitions and was able to talk fluently and do things that I couldn't do when I was sober. And so it was kind of a crutch for me. I worked in Chicago and lived in Gary, and I used to stop at the Chicago's Last Chance to pick up a case of gin, a couple of bottles of what do you make martinis with? I can't remember anymore. Vermouth. Got it. I'm gonna wait for it too long, right? Anyhow, I remember that I didn't want my family to know how much I was drinking, so I would water the damn gin down. Well, it's pretty easy to do that. You know, take a swig or two of gin, put a little water in it. But eventually, it got real bad. And one day, we were at a gathering, a real good friends of ours. We used to play bridge every Friday night. And we were over at their place, and I was being a little bit obnoxious, I guess is a good word for it. And I got my dear wife's ire up, and you know, you never want to do that. She pitched a full glass of beer in my face that night, splattered it all over freshly wallpaper room. She was pretty embarrassed about it, and I was shocked. But I got over it. And everybody thought, you know, laughed, thought it was kind of funny and that sort of thing. But I know Mary's always felt kind of really bad about it. But anyway, about that time, one weekend I came Saturday morning. I knew I was in the doghouse. I could tell by the ice, you know. Mary and my two daughters went shopping, and I picked up the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had had the phone number in my wallet for some time. Now, I don't know why, but, you know, I was reading all these articles that you see, you know, if you do this and do that and do that and do that, you're probably alcoholic. And I always found something I didn't do, you know. So, I never qualified. But I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing they wanted to know was my name, you know. I knew what anonymous meant, so they wanted to give them a name. And they finally said, well, we just need your first name and a phone number. We'll have somebody from the program call you back. It was on a weekend. It was an answering service. And I got a call back not too long. A fellow by the name of Bill. Some of you know Bill Hanson. He became my sponsor, and he had a voice that was down, way down. You could hear him a mile away. Bill says, well, I'll come over and see you. I said, no. My vision of an alcoholic was a great coat, a long beard, mismatched shoes, and a shovel, you know. And I didn't want anybody like that walking up my aisle, my driveway, you know. So Bill says, I'll meet you at the big wheel. I said, okay. How will I know you? He says, never mind, I'll know you. we have a look about this, but anyway. I met Bill, and he told me his story. And he was an alcoholic. He had all the attributes of an alcoholic that I had in my head is what you needed to be an alcoholic. You know, he'd been in prison, he'd made alcohol out of shoe black, and all the things that you read about and hear about. Boy, this guy's really got it. You know, he convinced me that I was not an alcoholic. So he made sure I had his phone number. He had a garage at the corner of Lake Street and Melton Road at the time. And I would sometimes stop there for gas and just make sure he's still there. I don't know time-wise when this was, whether it was a year or 2 years before I eventually stopped drinking. But I kept in touch to make sure he was still there, but never called him. As we all know, alcoholism gets worse, and it was getting worse around our home. I was making life really miserable for my family. Not that I was beating them up or doing anything like that, but I was not being a father and husband. My wife was so concerned about it, she talked to her doctor about it, because she was a basket case, believe me. We do that to the Al-Anon side of our family. We make real basket cases for our family. Anyhow, he suggested two things to her. One, that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And two, if you won't go there, try the alcoholic clinic on West Fifth Avenue. Well, she got me in the corner of the kitchen, the dinette where we lived. And she and my daughters were sitting there, and they were kind of laying down the law to me. You got to do something. Why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I tried that. I called them. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. Well, will you go to Alcoholics Clinic on the Fifth Avenue? And, you know, just to get her off my back, I said, okay. So I went down to this clinic on Fifth Avenue and signed up. And we sat in a circle, and they tried to talk like we do at an AA meeting, and it, you know, stroked my head. And the doctor that was assigned to this clinic prescribed some Valium for me. And I had, you know, it's strange, as much as I drank and as long as I drank, I had a real fear of drugs. That just was out of this world to me. It still is, as a matter of fact, but at that time, you know, drugs were fearful. But I went to the druggist in Miller, and the guy there that ran the drugstore knew me, and he refilled the prescription, and he said something like this: "Art, be careful, these things can do a job on you," or something like that. I said, okay, and I took a couple of those pills. I didn't like the way they made me feel, and being fearful of it, I dumped it down the toilet. Now, I went to these meetings, I think, about 5-6 weeks, so I can't remember, I don't have a record. I found a record where I was to have an appointment there on the 7th of January, 1970. And, but anyway, I went to this meeting once a week, and would stop on the way home, have a couple of drinks. You know, it was ridiculous. I just couldn't stay away from it. Ross Stanton, the man that was running this guy, he was a former youth cop in Gary who has been dead many years, but he ran this outfit, and he took me to my first AA meeting. Again, he got me in a corner. People had to get me in a corner to get me to agree, but I needed to get off my back. I said, okay. And so he wanted to pick me up, and I said, no. I met him at the big wheel, and he took me over to the meeting. Excuse me. It was a Miller, Etta Miller, Miller Etta meeting. And there were several people in the meeting, one or two, that I knew. One of them just died this week, Bob Evans. he reached out his hand and said, "Welcome, Art. We've been waiting for you." That went over like a red balloon. But what I got out of that meeting, the people were happy. And the one thing I can remember about it is to pass around a coffee cup for the donation. And they wouldn't let me put a buck in it. And I thought, "Oh, that's kind of nice, you know." So I came back. They called me at least four or five times during the week. "You want to go to this meeting, that meeting?" And I said, "No, I'm too busy." But I went to that meeting for 5-6 weeks, and I did not drink. I had put it all together by myself. And my job was construction, and we were putting bids together. And we used to work long hours doing that, sometimes through the night. And but this 5-6 week deal had enabled me to get things straightened around home a little bit so that I could arrange a vacation up in Door County. And so we had the bid to go in on Monday or Tuesday. I can't remember exactly what day. And I took the family up to Door County and then went back to Chicago to work on this. We had rented a room to put the bid together. And I used to say that I took my last drunk after the bid. But looking at my little, I have a diary that I kept, and I used to keep a little, you know, I wouldn't want to write that didn't drink today or drank today. I didn't write that. I had a little diary. 1, 2, 3, it would be 1, first day, second day, 3 days, and XXXX means I drank. Well, during this springtime, I got up to 30 days. That was before I got to my first AA meeting. I'm getting things all screwed up here somewhere. But anyway, I would try to get through, you know, more days, more than one day at a time. Anyway, after the bid, we went to a restaurant. It was a country club. Had all the nice trimmings, you know, linen, tablecloth, and the silverware, whatever. And we always, what we did was usually have a nice big dinner, a few drinks, go home and catch up on our sleep. It was my intention to have a nice dinner and head for Door County. And the waitress came around and said, "What would you have?" And I said, "A martini on the rocks with a twist." And the minute I said it, I knew I should not have that. But the next thought that came into my mind was, "One won't hurt me." I had that one and another one and then headed for Door County. It lit the fire. I felt it going down. I got feeling good. And every bar, I didn't stop at too many bars because I'd stop for one and stay for 12. That's what happened. I stopped here. On roads I'd never been on in my life, you know, and it took me about 8 hours to do a 3-hour drive. But it was the most miserable holiday that the family ever had, I guess, because I was out of it for the whole time. I got back to work, and I was still out of it. You know, I just couldn't seem to catch it. I even made novenas. I was a Catholic, and I had novenas. I used to make novenas whenever I wanted something. And sometimes it got them, sometimes it didn't. But I made a novena, and there was a little old Catholic church of St. Patrick's that around the corner from where I worked in Chicago. And I'd go in there and I'd sit down and pray as best I could, ask him for help. And I even talked to one of the priests there. He says, "Well, why don't you get with your people?" I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I guess he was talking about AA, but I don't know. But I do remember during this time that, not quite, no, Mary had enough, and she gave me an ultimatum. either you do something, you leave, or we leave. You know, I had kind of a choice there. And I knew she meant it. Anyway, if you bet my wife knows that. She's very straightforward. So I got on the horn to talk to Bill and asked him, what can I do? You know, and so he introduced me to a guy down in Chicago that I went to see in the merchandise mart. Found the guy. He took me to lunch, offered me a drink, and I said no thanks. And he told me a little bit of his story. He was a guy that was a millionaire, was now selling rugs. I mean, he was in bad shape, or he was in bad shape. As soon as that luncheon was over, around the first corner, I went into the first bar and got myself a drink. Because I needed that drink. At any rate, sometime during this period of time, I was so desperate, I said, God help me. That's all I said. And right after that saying that, I got a feeling that everything was going to be okay. Now, that lasted about a millisecond, but, I had that feeling that everything was going to be okay. So, the car was kind of battered up. I'd hit something the night before. I took the train into work, told the boss I was going to take some time off, and came back to Gary. And I remember I had about 30 cents in my pocket, and I returned train ticket, and I passed the bar in the station, and I could buy a beer for 30 cents, and I bought a beer, and that was the last time I had. I came home, and I went through the withdrawal that week. I got in my pajamas and sweated, just terrible. I was up and down, changed the bedclothes two or three times that night, and got through the next day. And these guys had promised me they were going to call me and talk to me. Well, they didn't call. They didn't call. They finally called Sunday morning. And we got together at the Big Wheel. We had Charlie N, who's one of the people there, Steve C, Paul Nichols, Ken Belloc, and I think there might have been somebody else. And they threw some options at me. You know, I could go to Hazleton up in Park Ridge, or I could go to Hazleton up in Minnesota, or just go to AA meetings. And this Charlie N said, if I was you, I'd go where the man is. And just something the way he said it made me decide, well, why not there? In a place called Linville. I said, okay, I'll go there. Well, he said, wait a minute, we'll see if they'll take you. So they called and arranged for me to be there and said they'd drive me up there. Well, I hadn't lost anything. I still had my two cars, still had a home and a family, but they were awful close to being gone. And so I flew up there. And you know what they do in airplanes? They sort of booze. Well, I thought, what am I going to do? And it was solved for me because they started serving booze at the other end of the airplane and started serving the food at my end of the airplane. I had some food in me and I was able to say no when it came to the booze. And of course I was worried about whether they'd recognize me when they got off the plane. Well, they knew me. I could see this haggard looking guy looking like he was hungover for a week or two. And I ended up in Linville for 3 weeks. Now, it was not affiliated with any hospitals. I didn't have any psychiatrists nor doctors. They had one nurse, and they had some doctor check us to make sure we were still breathing. And, it was all AA. And we talked about the 12 steps of the Alcoholics program for 3 weeks. I think I arrived there somewhere around step six, I'm not sure. And we went through them a couple of times while I was there. They strongly suggested to me that I take my fourth and fifth step while I was there. They pointed out this way, when you get back to your better business world and what you're doing, you may not get around to doing it. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea. So I put it off until the last week. And I don't know how I did it, but I finally did what they said to do. I mean, I finally followed the instructions. They said, sit down with a pen and a pad of paper and start writing. And that's what I did. And I know you've all written letters, and I know that when you're writing a letter, you think of three or four things to put down on that paper while you're writing one thing. It just didn't seem to pop in your head. That's what happened with me. I was able to put down all the crap that was festering in my head onto that paper. And when I was done, I didn't even look at it. I closed it. And, the next day, I read it over, and you know, the fifth step says we talk to God and another human being about the exact nature of our wrongs. And I had to look over this thing and see where the hell I was at. Well, I really wasn't capable of doing some kind of a dissection like that. But I went into my fifth step anyway, and there was an alcoholic priest there who I did the step with. And he helped me. You know, we didn't talk about all the little nitty-gritties. We tried to find out just what the problem was, you know. And he helped me through that. He helped me do a fifth step that I am still satisfied with. The beautiful part about the fourth and fifth step is we take an evaluation of ourselves. We tell it to somebody, and then we can quit letting it fester in the back of our head. We can get on with doing what the rest of the program says. And that took a lot of work. And it took, I came back to, after that time in Linville, and I had a lot of fear. My job was one where I had to entertain people and bring some drinks and that sort of thing. And I had to go to parties and that sort of thing. And my sponsor said, well, you know, we suggest that you take somebody with you, you know, that's on the program, or some your wife or somebody else. You know, go early, go late, leave early. And he suggested, I'll come over and go with you. Well, if anybody's known Bill, that alone would scare you sober. he was a really rough looking guy, and he just scared me. He and Steve, the two of them. I ran scared a lot because I didn't think I could handle it by myself, and I can't handle it by myself. It's an impossibility to handle this problem by ourselves. We need the help of Alcoholics Anonymous and all the people around it. I eventually got, you know, there was one day I got sober in September. It's one day in July. Did I realize I hadn't thought about taking a drink? And that was a really an A1 day in my life because, hey, I didn't think about taking a drink today. And I wasn't fighting it like I was. But I was fighting it all those other months, you know. And I was doing what I was told to do. I was told to go to several meetings a week and to contact AA and be with AA and do some readings and ask God for help in the morning and thank Him for the day at night. I did all these things and I still do all these things. You know, today I go to meetings and you think, well, what the hell does he have to be at a meeting? You know, I don't have to be here. I love being here. Which is what Bill Hansen said the day he took me at a meeting in Jim Kirk and he thought he was nuts. But, yeah, I do. I love being here. But the other reason is I am built, I'm a human being, and we all have the same problem. We forget pain. You know, there wouldn't be anybody in any room if the women didn't forget the pain of childbirth. So pain is something we forget. And I need to be reminded that if I don't do what I'm supposed to do, I will drink again. I have seen it happen with several friends who didn't do what they were supposed to do. Now, it's not the same thing with every individual, but whatever we do, we need to keep doing it to keep sober. 5 years after I was on the program, I got an opportunity for a job in Abu Dhabi. Now, the guy that called me says, would you like to go to Abu Dhabi? And I said, what bar are you in? You know, never heard of it. Anyway, Bob talked me into trying this job out. It was a job of speculation over in the Middle East. I was excited about it. Since a kid, I've always thought about Lawrence of Arabia and all that fun, you know. So I decided that, yeah, okay. I was unhappy with the job I had, happy with the way they were going, so I said, okay. And all I had to do was convince my wife, and I did that. We sold our home, and we moved over to Abu Dhabi. And I was over there about 6 months until I ran out of the money. They allotted for me. While I was there, you know, the first thing I realized when I accepted the job was not going to be, what do I do? So I called General Service Office in New York, and they said, well, all you have to do is give us a letter and send us a letter, and we'll get you in contact with other AAs. So I did that. I got over there. I did that, and I got a lot of letters from my groups. At the time, I was active in the groups up in the Schaumburg area, and so I had these letters, and I had my AA books, and I had my readings, and I was able. And you know, everybody says, "Well, it's dry country." Well, that's baloney. There's lots of booze there too. Anyhow. I had to come home and pick up Mary. I was over there alone for a while, and I had to come home and pick up Mary. And the day before I was to come home, I got a phone call. In fact, I got a letter that day from New York saying that they had found another AA in Abu Dhabi, and his name was so-and-so, and his phone number was so-and-so, and his address was so-and-so. And then they sent him a letter the same way. And he called me. I went over, met him, went over, and we sat from about 7 o'clock in the evening till 3 o'clock in the morning to the deck. And so I left the next night for home, and he said he'd meet the airplane when he came home, came back. Now, the airplanes arrived at 2 o'clock in the morning, so he met me the next and came back 6 weeks later. Dez and I started an AA meeting over there, and we call it the Al Itnain Group, which is Arabic for Monday Night Group. And they understand they now meet on Wednesdays. But you're still going, from all I can understand. I haven't any contact with anybody who goes to the meeting or anything like that, but I do know that while we were there, we had three or four people that we one we work with, another couple we helped, And I have been in contact with one guy from India and Des from Ireland ever since I'm in the program. This year is the first year I haven't heard from either one of them at Christmas time, so I hope they're still well. But AA is everywhere, and the fellowship, the General Service Office, it serves a real good purpose, getting it to guys like me, and there's a lot of loners out there who have no way of getting to an AA meeting, and yet they stay sober. So, it's not just getting to AA meetings that makes us sober. It's working the program that makes it sober. And we can do that without the meetings, but boy, the meetings are one hell of a help. I got all these notes. I don't think I said half of what's on here. I usually close my meeting with suggestions that I got from Linda. And I have, to the best of my ability, which is not perfect, tried to work these suggestions. I have regular hours for rising and retiring. Use a prayer and meditation book or a 24-hour book of confidence in God. Eat regular meals. Take AM and PM breaks. Have daily contact with an AA member. Read 2 pages from the big book daily. I tried to do that. Never was very successful. I'd get into the book and I'd read 3 or 4 chapters and then put it on the shelf and I'd come back to it for 6 months. I'm still learning. Contact AA when out of town. Concentrate on today's problems only. Make frequent use of serenity prayer. Attend the church of your choice at least once a week. Take daily inventory. Do a good turn for someone each day. Remember, AA begins at home. Be thoughtful. Attend meetings at least twice a week. Learn and live the 12 steps. At bedtime, say a prayer of thanks for another day's sobriety. And on the blackboard, there was a big sign. It said, "Prayer changes things." And small letters at the bottom, it said, "Even me." I have made copies of that if anybody's interested in putting it in their 24-hour book. I've had a lot of help over the years. A couple of things I want to mention. For a while I was going out to Maximum Security in Westville talking to the inmates there at the AA meeting, and John Schaefer, who we heard earlier, talked about, heard about it. And then he says, "You're not going out there alone, are you?" "Yeah, I'll go out with you." So for several weeks, John used to come by and pick me up and we'd go out there. And he was one of the stalwarts of the program that I thoroughly admired because he really worked his program. When I became active as a DCM, a couple of times I asked John to go with me to the meetings in Indianapolis, and some of the stories he told me about how in the early days the black people had trouble finding a block to eat on the way to a meeting, and trouble finding a place to have meetings, and it makes me think, boy, I was luckier than hell, because I didn't have any trouble. My trouble was all with me. And then there was several other people in the black community that Henry Johnson I knew not too well, but I knew him. And of course, Marcel, I can't even remember his name anymore. Hotel. I got jammed tonight. Don't ask me where I was tonight, you know. And I don't think I got anything else that's going to confuse you any more than I have it now. So I do hope that if anybody's new here, give this program a real try. You know, try it the best of your ability. You know, you can't do it the way the guy across the table does it. You have to do it your way, and you're going to find your way if you put your trust in God. And he will help you if you ask him. Now, you won't if you don't ask him. So you need to ask God for help. And I think that's the same as around the program. They're not going to help you unless you ask them. But if you ask somebody for help, boy, you're going to get it. And I think I've said enough for today. And thanks so much for being here for me. And I really appreciate seeing so many great friends.